Welcome to The Babblery, conversations where we explore the knowledge, opinions, passions, and obsessions of my guests. This is Suki Wessling, and today's program was recorded for Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM, Santa Cruz, California, streaming online at www.ksqd.org. The way the back and forth of the abortion debate is presented in the media, I notice that there is very little nuanced conversation. I realize that part of this is intentional. People on both sides of the debate know that a lot of people don't listen to nuance, so each side has its slogans, which they have used to good effect and tend to bear down on, even in situations where more nuanced discussion might actually be helpful. Nuanced discussions about abortion can push a lot of buttons. I certainly pushed my guests' buttons at my insistence that instead of getting sidetracked into topics of women's rights and politics, which are certainly worthy of discussion, I wanted to spend an entire hour just talking about how abortion is an intrinsic piece of comprehensive health care. I think that many Americans, or perhaps most Americans, are woefully undereducated when it comes to health care and especially health care systems. It's not their fault. Our health system largely promotes the idea that any malady that someone suffers can and should be treated as an individual event. If you have cancer, you go to one kind of professional. If you're obese, you go to another. This compartmentalization is definitely improving, but our system has a long way to go. When it comes to abortion, however, discussions never seem to touch on the nuances of how deeply integrated abortion is into healthcare. Depending on who you talk to, something referred to as abortion happens everywhere from contraception to treating sepsis, from mental health care to murder. It's a hugely entangled web. You'll hear my panel push back at me when I want to separate out a life-saving abortion from other abortions, or an abortion for mental health reasons from other abortions. They make a valid point that all abortions are potentially life-saving, all abortions relate to mental health, and all abortions are necessary from the point of view of the person who has chosen how to regulate her fertility. But I believe in order to truly understand what outlawing abortion does to women, it's important to truly understand all the downstream effects of the removal of this procedure from comprehensive medical care. The downstream effects on women's health are known. If Roe is overturned by the Supreme Court, women in around half the states in this country will be less healthy and die at a higher rate. Their doctors will be afraid of or even enjoined from telling women the best choices they can make for their health. Educators will be afraid to help young women understand their bodies. The dedicated people who work in clinics that provide abortions while also caring for the health of the entire person will be silenced or put out of business. I feel strongly that everyone in a democracy needs to understand the downstream effects of their choices. Politics is not separate from us. It determines many facets of our lives. Every person in this country who votes for an anti-choice politician is making the choice to lower the quality of comprehensive health care for women. They should understand that that's the choice they're making. Now on to the show. To Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program, brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling, and today I am hosting a panel discussion about how abortion serves as an integral part of comprehensive health care for women. The coverage of the abortion debate in most mainstream media highlights polarized political arguments that do a very poor job of representing what really happens in clinics and hospitals everywhere in the world. It's not uncommon that hard choices need to be made during pregnancy, and the polarized political debate just makes these choices even more difficult. I'm going to start by stating my personal stance on this issue, since it is not neutral. I have always been pro-choice in the classic sense of protecting all people's right to make decisions about their own bodies. However, once I had my own children and developed an interest in how healthcare is delivered in this country, I came to understand that attitudes about pregnancy and birth are woven deeply into the healthcare that is provided to those who are pregnant. I hope that this discussion will clarify how keeping abortion legal is intrinsic to providing appropriate health care for all. Please return next week for Christine Barrington's interview with Bettina Opthecker, and on July 4th for another panel discussion that I will host about the social aspects of the abortion debate. Today, I am so glad to be joined by this panel of caring and devoted health care practitioners. Jessica Dieseldorf is a nurse practitioner and senior program manager of abortion services at Planned Parenthood Marmonti. She has worked in abortion care for 24 years as a provider and trainer. She trains other advanced practice clinicians in both medication abortion and in-clinic procedural abortion. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Suki.
There's a lot of misinformation about abortion that's disseminated, not only by fake crisis pregnancy centers, but also by politicians and media. So I wanted to start with clearing up a couple of issues before we proceed. And these were some questions that I wanted to ask our other two guests, who will hopefully be here momentarily. But I wanted to ask you, Jessica, if you could give us a little background on what's going on as far as, you know, this Supreme Court final decision. We don't know what it will be, but it's likely that the abortion legislation will be sent back to the states, which means that California will remain a place that provides legal abortion. What's going on with Planned Parenthood Marmonti and your mood there, your sense of how things will change and what you're doing?
Thank you, Suki. I hope you can hear me well.
I can.
Thank you again for the opportunity to talk to you. This is obviously a really high energy time for Planned Parenthoods across the country and other abortion providers as we look to this major Supreme Court decision and the major shifts that come with that, when about half of the country will at that point be severely restricting abortion and access to abortion or banning abortion altogether. As you mentioned, California is gearing up and shoring up to be a safe haven for abortion care and for the right to seek this essential medical care. Within Planned Parenthood Marmonti, I work at Planned Parenthood Marmonti, which is a large Planned Parenthood affiliate here in California. Our geographic territory stretches from Yuba City down to Bakersfield, and we also have a location in Reno. So that's where the name of our organization comes from the Mar to the Monte, from the Central Valley all the way to the coast and the peninsula. So within our large Planned Parenthood affiliate, we are preparing to increase access. So not only to protect access for the patients in our local communities that we serve, such as Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz County, Watsonville, and downtown Santa Cruz, but also to provide access for people who may be fleeing from other states where they're not able to access that kind of care. So there are varied estimates about how many more patients per week we may see, and it's an ever-changing situation that's kind of a domino effect. We've seen some of this domino effect occurring with the severe restrictions on abortion that came into effect in Texas in September last year. Many, many patients left Texas to seek care in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has recently passed really, really strict restrictions and bans on abortion, which is then causing patients to have to travel further to access abortion care. Mm-hmm. So as we see the domino effect of different states shutting down access, we're going to see those folks in California as well. So there's a lot of energy and a lot of hard work ahead in not just protecting what we have, but also expanding access.
Okay, thank you for that summary. I believe we have our other two guests on the phone, so I will repeat my introduction of Dr. Jen Hastings, who is a family physician and assistant clinical professor at the UCSF Department of Family and Community Medicine, and was a physician at Westside Planned Parenthood from 1998 to 2018. Jen is engaged in research on trans and gender expansive reproductive justice issues. Welcome, Jen.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you now.
Yay. Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. And Dr. Letitia Oderman graduated from the University of California, Davis School of Medicine and did her residency at UCSF. She provides comprehensive OBGYN healthcare for people in Santa Cruz, including abortion in the first and second trimester. Welcome, Letitia.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Good to hear your voices. Glad we finally connected. So I was hoping to lay a little groundwork, because what we want to talk about is health. And there's some misinformation out there. So let's start with that first. And Letitia, I want to send this one to you. There's a lot of information, misinformation about abortion that's disseminated not only by fake crisis pregnancy centers, but also by politicians and media. So I wanted to ask you, generally speaking, let's get into specifics in a moment. And I know you might assume that most people know this, but I would love to have you on the record with the answer, which is, how safe is abortion relative to childbirth in the United States?
Yeah, great question. So this question has actually been pretty rigorously studied. And I think, unfortunately, all the data we really have access to is in a meaningful way, and I'm a data person, is really mortality. So when you look at mortality rates associated with live births and legal induced abortions in the United States, people have looked at data between 1998 and 2005. The Center for Disease Control, or the CDC, which we now all know so well because of COVID. Basically, I think that probably the easiest way to digest it is that the risk of death associated with birth is about 14 times higher than that with abortion. First trimester, and then if we were to divide that, you know, first trimester abortion where the vast majority of pregnancy terminations are occurring, you know, that number would be even higher. Mm-hmm. Leaps and bounds safer than birth.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important place to start. And I wanted to add in the second layer, and I'll address this to you, Jen. These numbers really change when you start breaking down the information in different ways. So how do the healthcare outcomes change for low-income women and other marginalized groups, such as transgender men, who are less likely to receive appropriate healthcare during a pregnancy?
Yeah, so we don't have great data yet for transgender men getting pregnant and needing abortion care. We have a few studies, but with small, you know, not enough data to give us global numbers. But we have very sobering data around when we compare non-Hispanic Black or African American people, Hispanic or Latina people, and then non-Hispanic White. So Dr. Letitia Oderman just gave us data on maternal mortality. That means pregnancy-related deaths. And in a study that was published in 2021, looking at 2020 data, we saw that maternal mortality, which again is pregnancy-related deaths, and in this study per 100,000 live births, 40.8, in this case it was women, died, compared to 11.5 per 100,000, compared to 11.5 Hispanic or Latino women, and 12.7% non-Hispanic White. So when we have, it's very sobering data around how care and deaths, there is less care, poor quality care, and increased deaths in our African-American community and our low-income women. And the irony is that in the states where abortion is restricted, that data around maternal mortality is also worse. So it's not what you would expect.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that I think that I would love listeners to come away with a picture of how abortion restriction doesn't just necessarily affect abortion. So that, you know, there's the simplistic idea that if you make abortion illegal or if you restrict it, that all those abortions won't happen and then there's no other downstream effects. But especially in the case, you know, I think the it's interesting to look at California versus Texas, and California, a state which has always had very good supportive abortion laws and also much more focus on women's health, the outcomes are just completely different, even though we have very similar situations otherwise. So, you know,
yeah,
once we go ahead.
Well, just the disparities in access and outcomes, especially for racial ethnic minorities and low-income people, is just very dramatic in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And really is a reproductive rights and a social justice issue.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about some specifics about how abortion happens in this country. And we're sort of going to go, I guess, in a sense, backwards as far as the numbers, because there's what would be considered the more dramatic situations that in the case of states that have restrictions but not total bans, they often have phrases like to preserve the life or health of the mother. And so I want to talk about what that means. And from what I've read, a lot of doctors say they don't actually know in those states exactly what that means. But Leticia, I wondered if we could start with you by talking about what does preserving the health of pregnant patients look like in real terms?
Yeah, good question. So certainly there are many examples from, I think, any practicing clinician who's been doing this long enough has, you know, a number of heart-wrenching stories of women who, for example, are faced with a terminal illness where the pregnancy itself may worsen their prognosis. So probably the most poignant example I could give you is a, you know, young patient of mine, 36 years old, has two children, came to me for a new OB visit. This was a planned desired pregnancy, and in which case we generally do a physical exam. And she had a large breast mass that unfortunately turned out to be breast cancer that was hormone receptor positive. And what that means is that the very hormones of the pregnancy would make the tumor grow and, worsen her prognosis. So she made the difficult decision to terminate. So that's just, you know, one example I could think of where we're talking about, you know, a life-saving procedure. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. And you know, it's so important to notice that in that case, you have a situation where you are having to choose between a mother and a potential child, but at the same time you're not, because really it comes down to the fact that there's probably, it's unlikely that that child would have been able to be born healthy and live a healthy life. Is that correct?
Well, I think this gets into a big moral ethical quandary. But I think even if you, I don't know if this is beyond the scope of this discussion, but even if you can see that a fetus is a person, we're essentially forcing the woman to choose between her own life or using her body to sustain the life of a fetus. So, mm-hmm. She's got her own family, children that two existing children, a whole community of folks that love her, And the very pregnancy that could keep the fetus alive is the thing that could kill her, mm-hmm. you know. And so those are extreme examples. You know, I know the other two clinicians on the call, and I feel very strongly that abortion should be accessible to any woman, that all women's reasons for termination are valid. You know, Jessica, in our sort of pre-meeting before this radio show, really succinctly put it, I'd love it if she could sort of repeat what she said when the three of us were talking, that, you know, sure. hopes and dreams are just as valid as a woman's cancer diagnosis, but...
Yes, thank you, Leticia. This is Jessica. I hear that word dramatic that you used, Suki, to describe, you know, to kind of bring out the story that Leticia's recounting of her patient with breast cancer. And it certainly is dramatic and heartrending and very, it's a very sad story. It's really important for me as a provider and as an advocate for my patients to experience and embrace the gamut of those kind of circumstances, that when people are pregnant and they, for whatever reason, will be ending that pregnancy, the gamut of the circumstances and how dramatic they are, it's not something for someone else to decide which abortion is more worthy. It's a really common experience to take care of multiple patients in a day for myself as an abortion provider, and hear stories that might sound mundane in mm-hmm. In comparison to breast cancer.
Yeah, and we're certainly going to get to those. We are going to have to take a break, so I'm sorry I've broken. But let's definitely get to that, and we'll take a break now. And when we come back, we'll talk more. I really want to work into how these abortion restriction laws result in healthcare, the degrading of healthcare for women in a much and for people who are pregnant in a much wider way. So we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about that. Thanks for listening to Talk of the Bay. We'll be back in a minute. I want to get back to this question before we move on about other sorts of health care that include what some people define as abortion but are necessary health care for women. And so I want to, you know, we have one example of a situation where a woman had to make a really difficult choice. What about other situations that women come in with that, if they were in a state that restricted abortion, might not get treatment for? Leticia, would you like to take that on first?
Sure. I think I understand your question. And maybe to expand on the question that you asked me before the break, which was, what are some examples that might affect a woman's health, in which case abortion could be a life-saving measure? So a few other examples for listeners that they may not think of. Another planned desired pregnancy where a woman's bag of water breaks before the fetus has any chance of meaningful life outside the womb. And I think a lot of people don't know that the fluid in the bag of water is really what expands the lungs, and we obviously need our lungs to breathe. So if the bag of water breaks before, say, 20 to 22 weeks, the baby would then not be able to breathe outside the womb for the rest of its life, mm-hmm. not to mention the fact that the mother could get sick and have a blood infection. So termination in that case would save the life of the mother. Preeclampsia, which is a blood pressure disorder, if it were to occur, you know, again, a planned desired, highly desired pregnancy, if it occurs before 24 weeks, you know, again, that's a life-saving measure. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question? Is that what you were asking me to expand upon, or did I miss it?
Yeah, no, definitely, because I know that one of the first times I became particularly aware of how anti-abortion laws affect women is I read about a woman who had the fetus died in utero. So she had what was dead tissue in her body, and her local hospital refused to take it out. So she spent days trying to find someone who would take out the dead tissue, the child that did not develop into a child. And finally, luckily for her, it miscarried naturally without medical intervention, and then they would care for her. But to me, the shocking idea that anyone would consider that abortion, you know, that these laws are so clumsily written.
Right. Unfortunately, there are examples in our own community where, you know, Dominican Hospital is a Catholic hospital, and so there are these religious and ethical directives that dictate the kind of care that women can receive. So, you know, I've definitely been in unfortunate situations like the ones I described, where a woman's bag of water breaks before 23 weeks, and even though I'm an abortion provider, I would literally have to transfer the woman to an alternative hospital to be able to perform that life-saving procedure for her.
And so, in a lot of places, people don't have alternative hospitals, or if they were in a state that had restricted abortion, such as this law, several of the states have laws that say they don't even have exceptions for anything.
Absolutely.
This is Jessica, just chiming in to say that another effect of these restrictive laws prevent people from getting that kind of care that Leticia is describing. If there are no providers who have experience and training mm-hmm. in that procedure, right? So someone may feel sympathetic to the person who has had a fetal demise and think, oh, this is okay for this person to have an abortion. But if there's not a Leticia who has the experience and the practice of doing, you know, the many abortions that it takes to become competent to provide this type of care, that person is stuck. And in many cases, people who are seeking more medically complex or later abortions after the first trimester of pregnancy need to travel to different parts of the country simply because there is no one where they are who's able to provide that care.
Yeah, and I certainly, when I do the next show that will be aired on July 4th, we will talk about how our social discomfort with abortion care has led to a lot of doctors not being trained in even the basics of life-saving abortion. And Leticia, you told me earlier, and I think it's an important point to make, that even in very liberal pro-choice Santa Cruz, you are perhaps the only doctor who performs second trimester abortions here?
That's almost true. You know, a few of my colleagues will do terminations until about 14, 15 weeks, and then from 16 weeks on, there's one other person that will do them under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. We'll do them for genetic anomalies, but not for, you know, sort of life socioeconomic reasons. So,
okay. So even here, and, you know, when we're looking at, in a sense, of the best case scenario, we still have a lack of care for women who are who need certain more unusual types of health care. I wanted to move on to this question of, because another thing that they do with these laws is they might have an exception for the mental health of a patient, and I think that it's been really fascinating to live in this time when our research into the brain and how the brain works and mental health has probably moved more rapidly in the last 20 years than it had in the 50 years preceding that. And one of the things that, the research has proven is that mental health is physical health and that the two are inextricably intertwined. But it just seems like our culture hasn't really absorbed that understanding yet. So maybe we can talk a little bit about mental health, physical health, and abortion, and how this this interplay is really important when it comes to providing comprehensive health care. Jen, would you like to start us off?
Sure. I think the foundation for this discussion is that actually abortion care is in progressive countries or educated countries is considered just a basic part of healthcare. And we did in California, we've done some great work really integrating abortion care into primary care. And both Jessica and I are part of a movement to do that in community clinics and in other primary care places. We're part of something called TEACH, which is Training in Early Abortion for Comprehensive Healthcare. So when we look at what does comprehensive healthcare mean, it actually includes abortion care. And that, I think what Jessica's point about if we don't have providers who have the skills to provide routine abortions, then we won't be able to help people who need them in extenuating circumstances when it may be life-saving in the way that we were talking about earlier. And I think what the three of us wanted to say is that life-saving can include when someone is severely depressed or anxious or has mental health issues, but also a host of other issues, including not being the right time in their life in terms of education, being a very young person. But to focus on mental health, I think I'll just stop there.
Okay.
Let Jessica take over.
Well, Jessica, I know you're passionate about the way abortion helps people in crisis. So could you speak a little bit specifically about mental health and the mental health related decisions that you see happening at your clinic?
Sure. Just again, as I'm hearing the panelists speak about Leticia's cases of really extreme examples of life-saving intervention of abortion and how that affects people's physical health, I think of patients across the spectrum of physical health, and I remember so many patients I've seen suffering from just really extreme nausea and vomiting in early pregnancy, and being able to restore them to just the very simple baseline of their health, of being hydrated, and not vomiting from the hormones of pregnancy, relieving them in a really simple and very common way, relieving them of the mental stress of continuing a pregnancy when they've decided that it's not the right time for them to have a child. Mm-hmm. So we can turn to really extreme examples of people who are experiencing severe depression, psychotic episodes, as examples of mental health. But if we look at healthcare and health in a more broad way, as those that, like Dr. Hastings and I know that Jen is a family physician, I'm a nurse practitioner, we're taking care of patients in outpatient settings, not in, we're not taking care of severely ill people. We're taking care of people with preventive care, treating some illnesses. Abortion really falls into that level of treatment. So in terms of the mental health burden, just alleviating that stress of the unwanted pregnancy, the pregnancy that the person doesn't want to continue.
Well, and one of the things that is important to remember, I think, is that the majority of women seeking abortion have children. Is that true?
Yeah, that's correct. This is Jessica again, just one of our main sources for descriptive information about the population of pregnant people who are seeking this kind of care is the Alan Guttmacher Institute. And the report from survey data and statistics about people having abortions is that almost two-thirds have already given birth. So whether they're actively parenting or not, they've given birth, and so many of our patients are fully aware of the work of pregnancy, right? Mm-hmm. So the work for their bodies and for their minds, and the work of caring for the families that they have, and very many patients, when telling us stories, describe their abortion, you know, in the context of parenting, in the context of caring for other people, whether that's their children or other people in their lives.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I wanted to, the reason I brought that up is that when you're talking about mental health specifically, if you have someone who's pregnant who is parenting children and perhaps has a history of postpartum depression or has been experiencing mental health, that pregnancy related mental health that is making them unable to care for the children they've got, that would be, I would think, a reason that some of them might give for needing to terminate the current pregnancy.
Sorry, go ahead, Leticia.
I got all excited because I love talking about postpartum depression and anxiety, which, you know, unfortunately are so prevalent. I think kind of local estimates are that, you know, they've dramatically, the diagnosis of postpartum depression and anxiety has dramatically increased. I would say in particular, you know, I think we're all aware of the mental health crisis that the pandemic has brought, the lack of support that, that families have during this time has really exacerbated the mental health crisis that we have. And so in that way, you know, abortion can be an incredible tool for restoring health, that, you know, spreading our families that much thinner at a time when they're already sort of maximally stressed just is an additional challenge. I think implicit in this whole discussion that I just can't not say is that birth control is not perfect. You know, all birth control, you know, when I talk to families or, you know, talk to patients about birth control options, there's pros and cons to each one. Nothing is 100%. I think there can be this feeling amongst maybe folks who are anti-choice or folks who've never had to deal with an unintended pregnancy, like, how did they let this happen? Like, you know, and the problem is we don't have perfect birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, folks are, we're always, abortion is just a fact of life. Women want to have and should have control over their reproductive bodies. And I think that the question we have to ask ourselves as a society is, no matter how you feel about the issue, women will continue to end their pregnancies. And do we want them to do it safely or unsafely? You know, many of us, I'm in my late 40s, and I, you know, didn't work in the hospital at a time when women were dying of abortions that they had performed illegally. But many of my older colleagues remember that. And I'm mm-hmm. deathly afraid that that's where we're headed in many states.
Yeah. I'm going to link to a couple of articles on the podcast page for this. And one of them has an estimate in Michigan of what they think is going to happen to the death rate if abortion becomes illegal there. And it's shocking to think that in the United States in the 21st century, we're talking about the death rate going up in a completely preventable way.
Right. And even, this is Jan, I want to just add to the conversation a study called the Turnaway Study that looked at what happened to women who were refused an abortion that they were seeking. And I think you were mentioning mental health, Suki, and in fact, women who were refused the abortion that they were desiring did have a documented increase in anxiety and loss of self-esteem in the short term after being denied an abortion. They were less likely to have aspirational life plans for the coming year, more likely to experience poor physical health for years after that pregnancy, including chronic pain and gestational hypertension, and that, in fact, being denied abortion had serious implications for the children who were born of that unwanted pregnancy, as well as for the existing children in the family. So denying an abortion actually not only is the abortion itself, would it have been safe, but the consequences of being denied now have been documented in this UCSF study called the Turnaway Study.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And that's a perfect segue into the last segment of this program, which will happen right after we take a break. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, and we will be right back. So I wanted to get back to where we broke off, because this Turnaway study is particularly interesting because of the fact that it traces the downstream effects of lack of appropriate health care for people who are pregnant. So let's start talking about that, because I think that a lot of people don't really realize that what the anti-abortion propaganda calls abortion on demand, which would be women who almost always, and most abortions happen in the first trimester. They're usually not done directly because of a maternal or fetal health. So let's talk about some of the reasons that people do come in for abortions and what the downstream effect of their not being able to get those abortions would be as far as their health and the health of other people in their lives. So, Jessica, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So, again, you know, looking at to the Guttmacher Institute as a really rich source of information through survey research about people, just really the very common reasons that people report for having, for choosing abortions. These are the things that are echoed every single day when I meet patients. The most common reasons being that having a child at this time would interfere with their plans for work, school, changes that they, goals and aspirations that they have for the future. Other common reasons are responsibilities to other people. So taking care of children that they have, taking care of other people in their lives. So again, responsibilities to others. A really, really important reason that we haven't touched on much is the fact that continuing a pregnancy and having a child can result in a lifelong connection to the person that was involved in the pregnancy, mm-hmm. That partner. And this may not be someone that pregnant person feels prepared to stay connected with, either because of violence in the relationship and abuse in the relationship, or because of not being compatible and not having those same goals in raising children together. So these are the most common reasons, the most everyday reasons for routine, regular abortion that people talk about. And for me, as an abortion provider, it's as I mentioned earlier, I work in an outpatient setting, so it wouldn't be usual for me in an office setting to be taking care of a person in a dramatic health situation, such as Dr. Oderman described, of the person with premature rupture of membranes and a resulting risk for sepsis and for a blood infection that could be, you know, life-threatening at that level. It's more rare for me to meet a patient who's in those kind of circumstances. And in the same clinic session, it would be really common for me to see the occasional patient with something extreme. I'm remembering a patient I saw at one of our locations in Monterey who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer and was going to be starting chemotherapy. In the same session, you know, the very next patient I saw was a 17-year-old who was going to be graduating from high school and going off to community college. And so, you know, to me, that just illustrates the gamut of those circumstances that patients find themselves in when they come for this kind of care. To me, as a provider who cares about the health of my patients in a broad sense, it's not enough to just say abortion should be legal and safe, that patients should not have to die from trying to access abortion outside of medical care. For me, it's important that abortion also be a loving part of healthcare, and that the experience be, you know, one where we really are embracing the patient as the expert on their own situation. I think that's what the Turnaway study tells us, is that people present for abortion knowing that they need to have it, knowing that their lives will not be as good if they continue that pregnancy. And the research showed that they're correct, right? They've made an assessment of their finances, their health, their family circumstances, their ability to have another child. And they're correct that if they don't get the abortion that they're trying to access, those outcomes are worse for them.
Mm-hmm. Jen, did you want to add to that?
Thank you. Yeah, I do. Thank you so much, Jessica. So beautifully said. And I think the integration of early abortion care into primary care, where, you know, as someone's healthcare provider, I can provide their abortion, knowing who they are, knowing their family, having connection, and even if I don't know that person, in an outpatient setting, we get to connect fully and provide both a safe and I think often less difficult physically for the woman when the person is in a comfortable situation. I want to return to one thing that Jessica made such a powerful point about, which is you know, who that partner is for the pregnancy. The Turnaway study also showed that by 5 years, women who were denied abortions were more likely to be raising children alone without family members or partners compared to women who received an abortion, and that women turned away from getting an abortion were more likely to stay in contact with a violent partner. So I think those are, powerful evidence that denying abortion care has powerfully negative consequences.
Yeah, and this is what I was, you know, hoping we would get to, that that you start with, and maybe people notice most the more dramatic situations, the more you know, top of the magazine type of situations where you have a person whose health is severely compromised or who is carrying a fetus that will not be able to live outside of the womb. And that is relatively easy for people to understand. But what you're all saying is that there, the effect on health, and maybe we should talk about this for a minute, what is health? You know, why does having to drop out of college affect a person's health? In their future health?
This is Leticia Oderman. Thanks for asking that question. I'm looking at the sort of bullet points of the Turnaway study, and I just want to read one sentence and then give you an example for my own life. So it says, women who receive a wanted abortion are more financially stable, set more ambitious goals, raise children under more stable conditions, and are more likely to have a wanted child later. And I'm an open book person. I'll just tell you that I feel so honored to be on the call with Dr. Hastings, because she was my first clinical mentor. So I'm 46, 26 years ago, Jen. 26 years ago, Jen was my abortion provider. I was a college student at UCSC. You know, knew I wanted to do something in women's health. Didn't, wasn't really sure what. Was it the advocacy or not? Had an unplanned pregnancy with my partner at the time, who was a great guy, and I think would have, and he's my husband now, fast forward. He was ready to have the baby, but I, you know, I thought, no way. You know, I'm working my way through school. I can barely take care of myself. I have ambitions and hopes and dreams. And so Jen just took such good care of me and really inspired me to want to provide that kind of care. And here I am, you know, all these years later, an OBGYN providing abortion care with two healthy kids, 9 and 11, who, and I think, you know, that's just a salient example of I got a regular abortion. I didn't have a, you know, fetal anomaly. I didn't have breast cancer. I didn't have colon cancer. But my, you know, the care that I received helped me be able to complete my academic goals. And, you know, the ripple effect of being able to care for folks in similar situations and then raise, you know, wanted kids and be able to provide them a great life as a as an adult who has more, you know, more to give as a parent. So, hopefully that connects with the listener.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing that. And it's a really powerful story because it serves to show that this is not any less an important decision, a hard decision for women who are doing it because of their life situation than it is for women who are doing it for other reasons. That as Jessica has brought up, that the reasons that people who are pregnant are living in their bodies. We can't exit our body for 9 months and say, okay, I'm just going to check out and this will just all be over. And then it's not going to affect my life. It will affect our lives. It will have deep effects on our lives, many deep positive effects, as well as effects that we can see as negative, even those of us who have given birth to very much wanted children.
This is Jessica again. I just want to add a little bit to what you're saying about abortion being a hard decision for people. In my experience in talking to patients, it's not always the decision of having the abortion that is hard. What is hard sometimes is accessing the abortion and getting the abortion. And I think that if a listener decides to do further reading on the Turnaway study, they'll learn more about the design of that really, really important study out of UCSF. This was not a study of people who were denied an abortion because of a restrictive law. This is a study of people who were not able to get an abortion because of logistics, mm-hmm. who basically, you know, presented at a place to have an abortion and they were one day over the limit of gestational age or, you know, the duration of the pregnancy for them to have the abortion that day. And that was a barrier, you know, it was difficult to get the abortion and patients were enrolled in the study and, or people were enrolled in the study, subjects, I should say, were enrolled in the study. The folks who showed up, let's say exactly at 12 weeks of pregnancy and were eligible, and folks who showed up at exactly 12 weeks in one day and were not eligible, mm-hmm. and folks were enrolled in the study and those outcomes were compared, right? And so again, it's not necessarily the decision of having the abortion that is difficult. Just to repeat, I think one of the main takeaways from the Turnaway study is that the people who chose to have abortions, they were correct in their assessments of their lives. They were correct that they were in hard times. They had hard financial circumstances. They had children to take care of. They had their own health to maintain. They had their own hopes and dreams for the future. And that having or not having an abortion definitely affected those circumstances.
Yeah, thank you for that. And for I wanted to tell listeners that everything that everyone has mentioned on this show will be available as a link on the podcast page, so you can check that out later this evening or tomorrow. We only have about a minute and a half left in the show. Amazing how the hour tends to fly. And so we don't have time for even a long statement, but if each of you could send us off with one thing that you hope, wish Americans knew about abortion care, just one sentence. So Jen, will you start us off?
Well, I've already said it, but I'll say it again. Abortion is just a basic health right, and can be easily integrated into primary care to provide people with the best health care possible for themselves.
Thank you. And Jessica?
It's really hard to sum it up into one sentence, but I would say the thing that I've been thinking about as we've had this great conversation is how important it is to respect the autonomy and the decision-making of a person who's pregnant.
Thank you. And Leticia, you have the last word.
I would say, this is actually a quote from a podcast that I recently listened to, that the law is crude and people's actual conditions are manifold. And manifold, I had to look it up just because I'm not that vocab savvy, but that we have numerous reasons why people come to the decisions they come to. And yeah, just to have respect for where other people are at.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, all three of you, for this conversation. Listeners, please check out ksqd.org and tune in next Monday for Christine's interview with Bettina Aptheker, and on July 4th for another roundtable discussion about the social aspects of the abortion debate. Thanks for listening, and please return again tomorrow at 5 p.m. for more Talk of the Bay. You've been listening to The Babblery. Please visit www.babblery.com for links and information related to this podcast.